I've just got a couple of questions. When you went through the sections, I tried to highlight what the key elements were. And how much of this is done, since you really presented this as a national problem and building and perspective, when you talk about standards of negligence and all on down through, how many of those have you adopted language from other states that are currently running? Or are these just strictly new and innovative processes? I wouldn't assume that they would be.
It's a combination. There, a lot of this is lifted to some degree from some of the cases in Oregon that have, the fundamental concept is that you don't serve a person when that person's visibly intoxicated. You start with that assumption, and that's in there pretty clearly. The reasonable business practices, I believe, was taken from a state that already had that, and I can't recall the name of the state. Most of it was lifted in one form or another from laws that are in existence at this point, or legislation from other states.
And then on the fifth section dealing with punitive damages, do you know what other states are using those, that process that you described that might be used here in Oregon?
I'm going to answer your question in a roundabout way, that at this point in time, regardless of this statute, generally when you are defending a punitive damages case or a claim in a liquor case, my experience has been you can bring in most of these good acts to show that in fact the bad acts that are being claimed aren't so. The problem is the continuity. I believe that one other state at least has essentially used this criteria and has codified it in legislative form.
Okay. And then when you talk about creating a fund, are there other states that specifically create a fund similar to, and I know you didn't draft this up, but are you aware of any other states that had that sort of system?
Looking at the legislative research that I was given this morning, you all have copies of that? I think that mentioned something.
Well, if it's in here, I'll go through it. I was just, my follow-up question perhaps is more important, and if it's in here, I'll look for that too. Was, were the sources of revenue for that fund similar to the license increase that you've talked about in this bill?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay. Do you know how many total licensees through OLCC that you're specifically trying to address through this legislation? For any of you?
Approximately 3,000. Right.
3,000. Okay. And then is there a certain type of establishment or a license holder that has had a more distinct problem than another type, although since their impact on the insurance carriers is so great that it's affected everybody?
I'm not a reliable source probably, but I can say from my experience, the problem with that question is you don't know how many bars weren't sued just because they didn't have insurance. There might be a lot of them that they didn't bother to sue because they checked and they found out they didn't have insurance, and so they didn't bother to make a claim against them. Of the claims I've defended, they've all been insured claims. Those claims seem to be generally slightly more leaning toward tavern than restaurant, although I have defended a number of nice family restaurants in the Portland, Salem, Eugene area. So.
Just one clarification.
Sure. From St. Phillips.
I might have been misled a little bit then. From your comment, I would assume if you were injured and you felt the party that served you the alcohol was negligent, you would sue perhaps whether they were insured or not insured, as is happening to you. for at least some remuneration, perhaps not as much as if there was some fat insurance carrier there protecting you, but you don't, isn't there usually litigation regardless to coverage?
I can't say that there isn't, but I would have to say my experience is that there is. Let me give you examples I can relate to. I have been in situations in which I am one of three or four bars where it's uncontradicted the individual may have drunk at. I'm the only one sued because I'm the only one with insurance. Mr. Rice's situation, I don't know if it's unique, but he did indicate he owned 10 restaurants, so that might give some clue to the person suing him that regardless of whether there was insurance, there might be a deep pocket.
So that's a derivation on the proportional liability issue.
Pardon?
The proportional liability, and that's so pick and choose who can pay and who can't. Is that? Well,
that's fairly typically what seems to be happening.
Okay. And then just one final question. Since I'm from the Portland area, you don't necessarily have to name the restaurants, but I'd be interested in just what types they are. You said they're family-style restaurants?
We operate a variety of restaurants, some which you might be familiar with in the downtown Portland area. Harrington's, which is on the ground floor of the Orbanco building. The Virginia Cafe, that's been there since 1911. J.T. Barringer's downtown, right across the street from the U.S. National Bank Tower. We have, within the last 6 months, opened Barringer's out in the Holly Farm Mall in Milwaukee, and also most recently in the Fred Meyer Shopping Center in Gresham. So if I were to characterize them, I would say casual, very moderately priced restaurants selling both food and beverage in a family environment and a bar and entertainment environment as well, a combination of the two.
Okay. And then just one more. The types of individuals bringing litigation, is there any pattern as to their age, geographic location, income level, or anything along those lines, or is it just a wide variety of folks?
A wide variety.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hill.
Yes, one, has this issue been taken to the insurance commissioner about this inability for you to get insurance? Has there been any kind of response at all?
I have not personally. I think Mr. Philippe would be the person that would be able to address that.
Joe, if you could. We'll have to ask you to come forward to make sure we record you properly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, yes, Bill Cross and I and several others met with Commissioner Driscoll last week and talked about the problem of liquor liability availability in Oregon, and she's very keenly aware of the problem and of our proposed remedies.
Is the agency in a position to offer any kind of a remedy, or are they just looking into it?
The insurance commissioner?
Insurance commissioner, yes.
Her position seems to be one where she either, well, apparently does not have the authority, and it would track with prior commissioners' feeling that they cannot compel insurance companies to write coverages that they do not want to write. She's a little bit stymied, I think, in that regard.
Is the insurance commissioner in a position to do any kind of studies to see whether she has authority to force anyone? I can understand that, but aren't they in a position to do some kind of studies to see if the position of insurance companies or carriers are justified?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, in my experience in the insurance business over 20 years, I've never seen the insurance department conduct that sort of a study, or if they have, it's not been one that's been widely made available.
Thank you.
Just one question for Joe. Do I understand that there are no domestic or in-state carriers or companies that are now offering this line of coverage, but which means that Mr. Rice or others would have to go out of state? Is that the situation we're in? Or are you telling me it's not available anywhere in the United States from any carrier?
Mr. Chairman, I'm saying not only domestic carriers, but foreign as well as what are classified as alien carriers. None of those are offering the coverage. Okay, I should clarify that further by saying that that statement applied primarily to establishments whose liquor sales are over 50%, and also large multi-state operations like Thunderbird, Red Lion, and so on are able to secure the coverage, I'm quite sure, because of their overall premium clout in the insurance marketplace.
Okay. Appreciate the clarification. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Ms. Jensen. Roy Dwyer. Sure.
When I started out today, it was raining. It was a lot of
good. My car's parked downtown.
I have to speak against this bill. My name is Roy Dwyer, and I'm a lawyer and practice in Eugene, and I'm a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers. I recognize the fact that there is a problem with the insurance, but I have to speak against this bill for quite a few reasons. I think you need to be in a situation that I've been on occasions when 11 o'clock at night, I've got a telephone call from someone that a relative that says my mother and my father were just coming back from vacation. They were coming down the highway, and lo and behold, right next to a tavern, a guy pulled out head on, killed my mother and father, and he couldn't even stand up at the scene there. And they gave him a blood alcohol level, and it was a 0.2 and a 0.3, and he'd been drinking. And I look at that, because at one time I used to do drunk driving cases, which I do no more for lots of reasons. One of them, I'm not very sympathetic with drunk drivers. And I thought, in order to present this in the perspective of the people who really, who are going to suffer from this bill, and that is, I think, the victims, that I looked up ORS 471030, which is Purpose of the Liquor Control Act, and I'm quoting it, to prevent the reoccurrence of abuses associated with saloons or resorts which dispense alcoholic beverages, and the next section, to protect the safety, welfare, and health and peace of the people of the state of Oregon. I was around when a 0.15 was permissible. You had to have a 0.1, over a 0.15 to be considered under the influence of intoxicating liquor. Now it's down to a 0.08. We have really cracked down on the drunken drivers in the state. And part of the problem is that, I think the restaurant owners and the bar owners are in a real box. They're licensed by the state. Their business is to sell alcohol, and if they sell people too much to drink, they're liable, no matter how they turn. But I think that the people have spoken, the legislature has spoken, that we don't want drunk drivers on the road. And the reason, if you think about all these laws that have been passed regarding, and it's not technically dram shop, but serving intoxicated liquor who kill, and the people who drink kill third persons, is a way to keep the drunk driver off the road. And I'm not sure if the two issues go together. It doesn't seem to me that we're addressing the issue about that. How do we keep the drunk driver off the road? If you look at this bill, what you're saying is that, number one, the people of this state are going to have to, through their driver's license, they're going to have to subsidize the liquor industry. And I don't know, I have a book here which is sort of spinal cord injury statistics, and another book of the cost of motor vehicle related spinal cord injuries. And I can tell you, if the person who's responsible for the accident cannot be held responsible, then it falls on our shoulders paying welfare for those people for anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million. So I think the law is good. I don't think it's an unreasonable burden to put upon owners of taverns to make sure that the people that they don't drink, the people who drink there are not visibly intoxicated. You can do that. It's very easy to do. And what I hear is, well, we're really busy and we're not experts and we really can't do that. And I don't think that's true. I think that people are trained, if they're sensitive to that, you don't send drunk drivers out on the road to kill. What this boils down to is that you're putting a price on innocent victims' lives. I don't hear anybody saying that if you cut the limit of recovery to $50,000 per occurrence, you're not talking about if five people get killed, I guess each get $10,000. But I don't hear anybody saying that if you have this, the insurance industry here saying that we're going to write insurance. You know, I've been around long enough to know that if you want to try to stampede something through the legislature, all you got to do is pass around cancellation notices to the people who are affected. And I think that it's responsible to want insurance, and I have no quarrel with the people that are here, that they want to be protected. But I think that the investigation really has to be to, number one, is there a crisis or is it a manufactured crisis? We need to look into it. We need to know what really, how many lawsuits have been filed, what premiums have been paid, or what claims have been paid out of that. And I don't think there's enough information. We're not looking from the innocent victim of the state. We're trying to put more hoops, more roadblocks in the way of the people who are killed and maimed. Unfortunately, and it seems like this all the time, the same person that comes out of the tavern drunk, and let me tell you something, these people have to be pretty drunk. I tried a case against Mr. English, if he's still here, on the coast. He brought a man in from the University of Oregon who testified that at a .20, a person is not visibly intoxicated. These cases are tough to win. When these people have to be drunk, I mean dead drunk. You don't win cases unless you have somebody to testify and somebody is just about dead drunk. That's my experience. And if you don't have the eyewitness testimony that the person was served and not visibly intoxicated, just weave a little bit, but drunk, you can't win. I just don't know how many cases there are. Mr. English does most of the defense work throughout the state of Oregon. And I think that there is a problem, but I don't think that this bill, I don't address each issue of it, but I don't think this bill solves the problem of getting the drunk driver off the road and making bar owners responsible that they don't serve visibly intoxicated people. In 1979, this legislature changed the whole law in order to bring the standard down to visibly intoxicated. And now we're asking for another complete modification of it and basically asking for no liability on part of the insurance, on part of the bar owners. That's all I can say generally about it. I just don't think it's what we want in Oregon.
Thank you. Dave?
Yes, I'm David Eves. I'm an attorney practicing in Corvallis with the firm of Ringel, Walton, Eves, and Stuber. I've been specializing primarily in bodily injury cases for a number of years, and I've been practicing for about 18 years. Just a couple of preliminary comments that I want to make, and then I want to address the bill specifically. The proponents have suggested to you the basis for their introducing this bill. And with any case, and Mr. English is certainly familiar with this, if you're a proponent for the bill, I think you have to establish to this committee's satisfaction that there is a crisis or there is a basis for the bill that's being offered. And for this committee to accept the testimony that's been offered as being any statistical basis to demonstrate that there is a need for a bill of this type, I don't believe they've shown it. If there is a crisis, as they suggest, I see no representative from ORBA or a representative group indicating what they've done to police their own or to establish some sort of criteria, either to administer certain rules, which they can certainly generate in order to eliminate this type of crisis suit, which Mr. English has alluded to. In essence, what this bill does is enhance on the burden of proof requirement that all innocent parties have who attempt to bring suit in the state of Oregon. we already accept that burden of proof as we do in any other personal injury case. And what they want to do is to increase that standard. And this bill is accurate in one respect, is it certainly limits liability. It limits it dramatically. And not only that, this bill not only wants to limit liability dramatically, it does not even want to encompass a mandatory insurance provision while reducing an individual tavern owner's liability to $50,000. More importantly, and something that's near and dear to me, and I testified before this committee at the last legislative session, are the notice requirements that are included in this bill. Not only does it limit liability to the individual tavern owner to $50,000, but it in essence eliminates liability due to this tactic which is available to the state and its various entities through the Tort Claims Notice Act. And not only does this include a lot of the language of our state Tort Claims Notice Act, but it's even tighter than that. Because at least under the State Tort Claims Notice Act, if in fact a state adjuster has actual notice or has been involved in the adjusting of a case, that 6-month notice requirement is waived. That isn't even allowed here. The concern I have, and let me give you an example, is a case that was filed more than 6 months ago against an individual who was intoxicated, was cited at the scene of this particular accident. I have two clients who have been seriously injured. It was only after filing the suit and taking depositions did I learn where this individual had been prior to his operation of the motor vehicle. Under this particular bill as proposed, my injured clients would be unable to proceed with a claim against that tavern, actually in this case it was a bar and restaurant facility, because under the tort claims notice, if notice had not been given within that 6-month period of time, they would be foreclosed or barred from the claim. Then, just to be a little more imaginative on this bill, which causes me to be somewhat suspect as to what the real intentions are behind the bill, they have another hooker. We hear here that we have this $50,000 limited liability to each tavern owner, but we're going to have this fund that somehow is going to be the cure-all that we will all contribute to. And yet, this innocent third party, if he files suit and yet fails to give notice within 30 days after filing suit to the OLCC, that individual is precluded from tapping this liability fund for damages which he is able to prove in excess of the $50,000. Now, these are just the notice provisions of this particular bill. Let me suggest some other things that are of considerable concern to us as attorneys who are representing these innocent third parties. Number one, Mr. English has indicated that there is an attempt to codify the existing law. If we already have the existing law, I suggest there's no need to codify it. The law is pretty simple, is you don't serve visibly intoxicated individuals. And the innocent third party has the burden of proving that you are, in fact, if you're a tavern owner, serving a visibly intoxicated person. And don't for a minute think that that isn't difficult to do when you may have a single individual who goes into a tavern and spends all afternoon and all evening there, and then goes out on the highway and involves himself in an accident. The other aspect of it has to do with this standard which allows ORBA and its individual taverns to fall back behind the shield of reasonable business practice. Well, gee, the Golden Horseshoe Tavern down the street handles their educational process of their employees in this manner. It should be good enough for us, and we want to offer that as evidence to show that we've met that standard of reasonable business practice. We go on to this issue of this proportional share of liability that we heard from Mr. English, and that is, if a jury finds that this individual who has a .23 is 80% at fault for the accident, and you have a judgment for $100,000, and the tavern is only 20% at fault, this bill would say that that tavern owner is only going to be 20% be responsible for $20,000. Now, in theory, that sounds like a great idea. Let's allocate the responsibility where it is. In practice, that may not be so good. Number one has to do with the insurance, the availability of it, and I think that as we hear, if in fact there is a problem with insurance, it's going to be difficult to pick and choose and find out where there is insurance so an innocent third party can recover. If you allow this proportional share of liability to exist, you're running contra to a jury or our just normal reaction to a situation. If you have Mr. Dwyer, who is responsible for an injury accident, and Representative Kopetsky happens to be the tavern owner that happens to be involved in serving this visibly intoxicated individual, the normal reaction of a jury is going to be, well, gee, he should be responsible for his own safety and be concerned about others. It's only normal to assume that he is going to be the most accountable party or should be the most accountable party. And yet, it was that tavern owner who clearly served that visibly intoxicated person. He was equally as negligent in terms of contributing to that accident and therefore should be held accountable to that innocent third party who has not been negligent in any manner whatsoever. The other little kicker has to do with this punitive damages. It's difficult enough. We already have the burden of proving punitive damages by a preponderance of the evidence, the greater weight of the evidence. That's the burden on a plaintiff. Now we're raising that standard considerably higher to clear and convincing evidence. The courts have had a difficult enough time with that particular burden over the years. It's somewhere between proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case and a civil case, and I think most of the courts are pretty darn convinced it's pretty well close to the standard in a criminal case. Subsection 6 of Section 1 talks in terms of a person is precluded from any recovery whatsoever if that individual has participated in, contributed to, or encouraged the intoxication of the patron or guest. And yet, what that provision attempts to ignore is the fact that we already have a comparative negligence statute in this state, which compares the fault of various parties, whether you happen to be a plaintiff or a defendant. I think that concludes my comments as far as this bill is concerned. I think in theory something needs to be done. I think ORBA has the responsibility of demonstrating that they have undertaken an effort to collectively to negotiate with either an insurance carrier or a group of carriers to fund their insurance, or they need to take the step to establish their own liability fund, similar to what the Oregon State Bar has. And until such time as they have demonstrated that, there is no basis or justification for a bill in any shape or form as proposed under the guise of this particular bill.
Thank you, gentlemen. Are there any questions? Representative Miller?
Mr. Dwyer, you began with your example of getting the call late at night and the person who caused the accident was falling down in the parking lot before they got in their car. Under this bill in Section 1, as it's proposed, you don't think that the licensee could be held responsible in that situation?
Yes, but up to $50,000.
Okay, that's... But under this language, that would be sufficient to find them responsible, regardless of the amount question.
True.
Wouldn't that enable a finding that they were liable?
Right.
Okay, I guess I got a different impression. Either one here on the... I think I heard Mr. Eve say that there was a new evidentiary standard with respect to the proof. This bill reads the proof by a preponderance of the evidence.
My
is
my,
that not
My comments were particularly directed to the standard involving proof for punitive damages.
Correct. Okay, so the first level is the same.
That's correct.
Okay, the punitive damages, do you think that ought to be as simple a standard as?
I think that applies to every other group in the state, and if it applies to every other group in terms of their conduct, why should we distinguish and make a special category for this group of tavern and bar and restaurant operators?
Tell me something about punitive damages, if you would, in the way that, and I don't know this. Lawyers who handle, let's say, personal injury cases often do so on contingency fee basis.
That's correct.
Is the percent of their contingency fee, is that hung to the regular recovery as well as the punitive recovery?
Yes, it is. But let me also answer this by saying, as I started off by saying, that I've been practicing for 18 years. My firm does probably 90% of our practice.
One of my clients, and I think very strongly that the bill as revised and now presented to you would certainly cover that situation. I view this revised piece of legislation as simply better refining the standards and criteria for assessing liability when indeed a licensee or a social host serves the visibly intoxicated. In 79, when I helped participate in drafting that legislation, the issue clearly was, and it was well aired, was, as you pointed out, Representative Miller, the question is, who should be responsible? Should it not be the one who consumes the alcohol unless the individual is visibly intoxicated? There have simply been a number of issues raised which are not answered in the legislation. And I think that we're talking about amplifying on the standards and criteria. We're not talking about changing the basic thrust of the bill. On the insurance issue, frankly, I didn't discuss that much the last time we were up talking about this bill because I have mixed emotions about just saying, well, the insurance costs are greater. But I assure you now the issue truly is not being able to insure yourself, notwithstanding a good track record, notwithstanding strict internal measures in terms of the service of alcohol. We're fortunate we do have the opportunity as private, nonprofit organization to have some greater internal controls than places of public accommodation. But notwithstanding all of that, we've been notified that we may not be able to secure insurance. Whatever the real reason is, that's a fact of life and a difficult one. We insist on being insured. We just would not go without it. But when you're told you simply, regardless of the price, can't get it, then that's a very real and difficult problem. We strongly urge you to support these new measures.
Thank you. Representative Kopetsky.
Quick question, the speeds. Does do the Elks clubs pool together and purchase their insurance? How does that work?
We've attempted to do that. Years ago, we did not. Each organization simply secured it themselves. I thought I could see some handwriting on the wall and strongly urged about 3 years ago that we get a blanket policy, not blanket, that's probably a poor choice of words, but that we have available kind of a blanket policy. And while not each of the 59 lodges opted in, many of them did. And that gave us some advantages, not just financial, it gave us some advantages to hanging on to the insurance. But it's that very carrier, and we worked at that very hard, and I personally participated in it, that very carrier is the one saying, you know, as a general proposition, you're a good client because we have, you know, a lot of establishments. But they're just taking a walk. They're just not interested in it under the circumstances.
Thank you.
And you know, and I think that's a major concern. A major concern as a matter of public policy. Do we want to have? Don't we want to insist that you be insured so that when there is a catastrophe, that there is coverage?
Any further questions? If not, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Ed Whitaker.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Whitaker. I have a both professional and volunteer background in the field of alcoholism. I also grieve with those who have described the loss of loved ones and the injury. I grieve, too, for the drivers who were not then and are not now being immediately assessed for the disease of alcoholism. As I told you last week in another bill, alcoholism is the cause of at least 75% of the DUI, not just here, but across the nation. Oregon, unfortunately, is now operating not in the 1920s or the 1930s, but almost in the puritanical vein in witch hunting. I think it's time for us to be pragmatic. Let's find out what works and what doesn't work. Whether you be a licensee, employee, or a host in your own home, the term visibly intoxicated is something we need to expound upon because of the tolerance level. Let me give you a hypothetical situation that takes place every hour of every day in every city. We're talking about maintenance drinking, a term that you may not be familiar with. An alcoholic, before he comes to your home or before he goes into a bar, may have two or three drinks before he gets there. He may have many more than that, and some en route. But because of very valid and good biochemical and physiological reasons, he has developed a tolerance for alcohol. If you perhaps do not understand the tolerance factor, stop to consider. If you cut your finger the first time you put iodine on it, ow. The next time it doesn't hurt. You develop tolerance. When you jump in a swimming pool, water at first seems cold. Then it seems warm. Has it changed? No. Your tolerance has changed. I know of and have treated alcoholics who for the last 10 or 15 years have never had a BAC of less than 0.15. You can reduce the BAC legally to 0.01 if you must. It doesn't mean anything other than the social drinker is going to get nabbed. It's not going to do anything about getting the alcoholic driver off the road. The alcoholic driver will show up and instead of being visibly intoxicated, will speak without a slur, will stand tall, and will present no problem. No problem at all, because you think he or she is in good shape. Is the alcoholic sick? Yes. Again, for biochemical and physiological reasons, which I'll not go into unless you want them, he must have that drink. He's sick when he's drinking, but he is sickest when he is not drinking. He needs more of the poison that's killing him. This has been proven time and again by medical research, by psychologists, and people in the field of therapy. So what happens when this alcoholic driver, who has not demonstrated any visible intoxication, leaves either your home or mine or a licensee? He gets in the car. Is he under the influence? Perhaps, but perhaps not. I know a truck driver who I don't think has been below 0.14 in the last 15 years, drives an 18-wheeler and has never been arrested for DUI. The alcoholic driver is going to present a special set of problems unless he is treated. He's going to get out of that bar or out of your home. And if you shut him off, that's not going to do anything because he or she is going to get a drink anyway. He's going to have some in his car. When he's involved in a collision, whether it be fatal, bodily injury, property damage, Then they run the BAC on him. They say, oh, my God, he was 0.24. Sure he was. He was 0.24. And he was operating not the way we normally do. A non-alcoholic operates under a formula, the formula being I above E. I meaning intelligence, the E being emotion. For the alcoholic, it is just the opposite. Judgment is the first thing that goes when any of us drink. That's why it's going to be awfully hard. You're dealing not with intelligence, but you're dealing with emotion. There's an old story that's told about the alcoholic who was walking along the beach. He found a bottle of Canada's Finest. Of course, it was empty, and there was a genie inside. The genie said, let me out, and I'll give you any three wishes. So he let the genie out. He said, I'd like to have this bottle be eternally full. It was. Just like that. He drank from it, and the bottle refilled again. He drank again, and the same thing happened. The genie said, look, I've got other things to do. What do you want for your other two wishes? I want two more of these bottles. It might seem funny, but to the alcoholic, that is real. He's going to protect his supply. So with or without visible intoxication, he or she will continue to get the booze one place or another. The disease of chemical dependency. Things that we must know more about. In your deliberations on these and other Dewey bills, I would ask that you ask the question of those who make proposals to you. Are they dealing with Dewey, which is a symptom of alcoholism, or are they willing to deal with the disease? If they don't answer that, then ask them, how many people have you treated for alcoholism, and what do you know about it? If they don't know, then you're being played games with. Be happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Whitaker. Are there any questions at this point? If not, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Carl Kruger.
Mr. Chairman, the next time you give me the opportunity to speak on all the bills at one time, I will. For the record, I'm Carl Kruger, representing Motor Vehicles Division. We have no position on the issue of whether the liability of persons and or establishments serving alcoholic beverages should be limited. We do want to raise some issues concerning the liability fund proposed in House Bill 2934. This liability fund will be financed in part by an additional driver license fee. Our driver license fees already are among the highest in the United States, because we attempt to recover the costs to provide the service. The tendency to look at the driver license as a way to add on fees for various funds concerns us, because the public doesn't understand that the total driver license fee also includes money earmarked for various funds unrelated to our costs. To the licensee, it's just the driver license fee, and they're concerned about the cost we charge for the driver's license. Perhaps more important is the policy question that concerns the liability fund. Should every driver in Oregon, at least some of whom do not drink, contribute to the liability fund? And that concludes my testimony.
Okay, any questions, Mr. Kruger? We do have your written comments, which are also part of the record. Thank you.
Okay.
Peter Blazer.
Peter Blazer, and it goes to the hearing on the
44. Okay. Gil, do you think he's going to be able to come back later this afternoon, or hard to say?
I can go ask him if you want to, but I don't know.
Okay. Hank Crawford. Don't know if Mr. Crawford could stay either. That's it for those who have signed up to testify. I don't think I've missed anyone. If I have, or if anyone wishes to testify but didn't sign up, please let me know. Okay, if not, we'll move on to our next and last bill for our afternoon session. That's $27.95. Mr. Dewey? Are you part of this too?
Yeah.
Sure.
State Representative Randy Miller, District 24. Appreciate this opportunity to be back before this fine committee. You'd like me to wrap up my comments before 7?
We're at your pleasure.
Before the 7 on the clock.
I might be able to do that, Representative Phillips.
That's when the big hand gets
up. Thank you. Theft of cable television service, which this bill addresses, has become a major financial item for many cable companies operating in Oregon and the United States. In 1984, it was estimated that $500 million worth of cable services were pirated nationally. And the Oregon Cable Communications Association estimates that theft of cable services in this state approximated $7 million. The cable industry has noted that theft of cable services is increasing as new services are offered and the average subscriber bill increases. Theft of cable service is not a victimless crime. Besides the revenues lost to the cable operators, subscribers pay a higher price as others steal, much like shoplifting. Franchise fees paid to the local franchise authority are less, since revenues are less. In addition, the programming and movie companies receive less revenues. There is currently a theft of service law in Oregon, but it is not cable specific. House Bill 2795 would clearly identify cable television service under the theft of service laws. The measure provides that the obtaining of a cable television service without payment is prima facie evidence that the obtaining of such service was gained to avoid payment. House Bill 2795 creates the crime of the unlawful distribution of cable television equipment under certain circumstances and the crime of tampering with cable television equipment. Also, the bill allows a cable television company to bring an action to enjoin or restrain violations of these sections and provides penalties. The measure does not speak to satellite receiving dishes, which perhaps if you've had any advance warning on this bill, some people are concerned that it does, and it does not, as that is covered by federal law. Being short of the big hand being on the 7, I'm going to stop my comments right now and allow more expertise commentary to flow.
Bless you, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Dewey, and representing the Oregon Cable Communications Association, and the far left is John Johnson, who is a cable operator and president of the Oregon Cable Communications Association. First, again, Representative Miller mentioned the satellite receiving dishes, the commonly known backyard dishes. This bill does not speak to that. Federal law has preempted that area, and so we're not interested in that, and the bill does not speak to that. But theft of cable service has become an ever-increasing problem for the cable industry. No cable system is without it. No system can reach its true penetration and revenue potential while it is prevalent. It has been estimated that the revenue loss, as Representative Miller said, nationally is approximately $500 million, and we estimate in Oregon it's between $7 and $8 million annually. Why is that? It's fairly easy for people to hook in to cable systems, and they do it in a variety of means. As Representative Miller noted, it is not a victimless crime, and the reason it's not is because the cable companies lose revenue. Subscriber bills are affected by that. We pay franchise fees between 3% and 5%. Cities, the franchisee, loses revenue because of theft of service. Programmers lose revenue because they're less subscribers, and the copyright payment that we make is based on gross revenues, and they are less because of theft of service. We are not interested in putting anyone in jail. That is not the intent of this legislation. Our position is, the cable television industry's position is, to turn someone who is a cable thief into a cable subscriber, and the prosecution is a last resort. I have, for the record, Mr. Chair, a letter that is addressed to you from the Marion County District Attorney, and if you will note this particular letter, he makes some comments I think worth reading. In paragraph 2, this is from Dale Penn, and I'll quote, "The proposed legislation will assist in successful prosecution of thieves who ignore the warnings provided by the company. Provision allowing certain evidence as an adequate prima facie case for the state is very similar to the provisions of ORS 165-065-2, which assists the state in legal proof for negotiating a bad check without declaring any improper presumption of inference which may violate constitutional provisions. While assisting cable vision companies in solving their theft problems, the statute will not have an impact in overcrowded jails. Provision will simply assist by more specifically defining the offense and providing a prima facie standard of proof." And I will stop there for just a minute. And as I said, we're not interested in putting people in jail. We are interested in trying to curtail theft of service, which we think is increasing dramatically. In the last few years, I have noted that there are 17 states that have adopted what I guess you would consider tougher standards in the United States, similar to this type of legislation, and it is pending in 12 other states. I think that is worth noting. I mentioned the figure of $7 million to $8 million in theft problems. We did a survey when we were getting the results back, and these are 1985 numbers, but this gives you the magnitude of the problem. System A is a fairly substantial system. They estimate that their loss due to theft of service is $650,000 a year. That's $650,000 a year, a cable system. That's 7% of their gross, and they estimate the loss due to converters, which converter, and we're going to talk about that, and we'll show you how people tamper with them shortly. They estimate the loss due to converters is $75,000. A small system with less than 3,000 subscribers, they estimate that 10% of the people there in the community are illegal connections. 10% of the revenue is lost because of that, which amounts to about $72,000. There is a system we got back that has less than 10,000 subscribers, and they report that 20% of the converters have been tampered with. This is to allow one to receive what are the premium channels and HBO or Showtime, that sort of thing. Total loss, they estimate, is $180,000. Another system says that their total loss is approximately $212,000, and it goes on and on and on. Just to give you kind of an example of the problem, this is a part of the survey, and this is a trailer park. And they took an audit on March 14, 1985, in this trailer park, evidently 68, they say, dwellings in the park, and there were 45 illegal connections in that particular park. All were disconnected on that particular day, locking terminals installed on the vacant ports. On 3/15 the next day, there were 9 illegals. So those people that were illegal, they just turned around and connected it the next day. 3 days later, there were 3 illegals. So you can see that there are some significant problems. Cable television, as you probably know, is not a public utility type service. About 50% of the people that can receive cable choose to subscribe, unlike telephone service or power service. We believe that the bill before you, and we have some amendments, and I believe those are before you, improve our capability of cutting down on the theft problems. And the reason I say that is, number one, currently, as you read the Oregon law, theft of service statute, it is not cable television specific. So when you go out and you talk to somebody who is an illegal, has an illegal connection, the first thing they say is, let me see the law. And you show them the law, and it says communication service, and it doesn't say cable television service. And they say, well, that's, you know, you've got to show me something else. And you're going to hear about the practices, and the first practice basically is to let the people know that they're violating the law and don't do it. We take action, usually a cable company will take action in the second time around. In Section 1, Sub 3 of the bill, we provide, as Representative Miller said, the obtaining the use of the communication service, cable television service, which is only available for compensation without payment, is prima facie evidence that obtaining such service was gained with the intent to avoid payment. And the reason we think that's extremely important is because, and you might not believe this, but the first thing that people will say is, I did not know I had cable television. I watched television, but I didn't know that I had cable television. I don't watch the movies, so I didn't know I had the movie channels. Or I don't watch the cable channels. I watch only the network channels, which are available via an antenna, and people will say that. And so you have to knowingly show that it was their mental state to that they were, in fact, attempting to avoid payment. We think it's important that we provide the presumption if certain factors are evident. As I mentioned, there are 17 other states that have adopted legislation, and they have adopted legislation similar to that. Section 3 of the bill, it would be new language if passed, and that provides that the illegal distribution of cable television equipment is a crime. The key word is the knowingly distribute, manufacture, possess, and so forth. And while we were waiting, I was talking to the cable television operator, and he said, I understand that the service bill is up, and he was reading me a newspaper ad about buy your converters from us. And this was a radio shack. You'll receive these mid-band channels. It's $29.95, these sort of things. There is a new section. We have amendments to that. If you'll note those, 410-1985, and that involves the tampering of cable television equipment. And we used to not have that particular problem, but we do now because of the high incidence of converters in the state or national. Converters allow you to get more than 12 channels, and as you'll hear further testimony, sometimes it's easy to break into a particular converter and move the equipment around to obtain services that you did not subscribe to. And so the amendment provides, first of all, for the knowingly tampering or otherwise interference for which you do, and then secondly, knowingly permit another person to tamper with or otherwise interfere with. And again, we have the problem here where people say, well, I didn't know it was tampered with, I didn't do it. And we're still going to have to, we still have problems in proving that, but we think it goes a long way in helping us. And then if you'll note in the new Section 6, that's new language, it does allow for cable systems to collect damages, attorney fees, and to enjoin or refrain in action. And then there are some changes, if you'll note, on the amendments from LC, and that has to do with, if you look at the bill very quickly, on page 2, line 19, it has, or otherwise duly licensed cable television system. Cable systems are not licensed. They're either franchised or authorized. And for that reason, Legislative Council is asking for the insertion, or we are asking for the insertion of the deletion of licensed and for the insertion of authorized. Unfortunately, Legislative Council did not check or catch that particular line, but they did, if you'll note, on line 24, but it's something that could be easily corrected from Legislative Council. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will stop, and if I may, I'll ask Mr. Johnson, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, to make some comments, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Chairman Springer, members of the committee, my name is John Johnson. I'm the president of the Oregon Cable Television Association. I'm going to make my comments very brief because I believe Representative Miller and Mr. Dewey covered most everything I had in my notes to talk about, and I don't want to repeat, and the hour is getting late. I also don't believe, at least to my knowledge, that there is any opposition to the bill. However, I would like to reserve our right to rebut if there might be some opposition later on. The Oregon Cable Association represents approximately 95% of the cable television operators in the state of Oregon. And they serve approximately 400,000 households. The association supports the bill, I think for obvious reasons that Representative Miller and Mr. Dewey have earlier stated. The FEFA service is becoming a very major concern and a very major expense in the cable television industry throughout the nation and certainly here in Oregon as well. Many states have enacted legislation, I think Mike mentioned about 17, and more each week we read about the additional states. We do have, as Mike had pointed out, existing law on the books alluding to or stating communication services, and it does not specifically state cable television services. And we feel this is the this is time now that cable television be made part of that that bill. I think at that point I'll stop, and if you have any questions, we have to ask them. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Just so everyone will know, I am awake today. I asked a question.
There are a lot of questions about that earlier.
I'm just going to call in. You talked a lot, Mike, about the cost of the cable companies. If we create a new crime, I mean, in a sense, it sounds like this is, what might be the cost for these Class C felonies? I mean, do we have any sense of how many people are out there that might be committing Class Cs and what burden this might be on the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I can't tell you exactly what the number is. We do have the operations manager from Viacom who is going to testify, who can deal specifically with what the problem is in terms of Salem. We don't see too many Class C felonies, though. It has to be over $200. You get to that by two ways, I believe. It's by a converter that is not returned that is worth more than $200. Or secondly, by if you can prove for some reason, and this is some of the difficulty in this whole situation,